slave there, upon the backs of my people was developed the primary wealth of America. The primary wealth. You have to have accumulated wealth to start, you know, to build. You did it another way here in Australia. You had to build your accumulated wealth too. You just came and took it. You know what I mean? And that's what they did in most of the countries. It's what you Westerners, what you Europeans did. You just took it. We got to catch up with you a little bit. So in America, so there's a lot of America that belongs to me yet, you understand? But just like a Scottish American is proud of being from Scotland, I'm proud for being African. Now in our school books, they tried to tell me that all Africans were savages till I got to London and found most of the Africans I knew and were going to Oxford and Cambridge and doing very well and learned their culture. And even once had, well, somebody had the temerity after one had conquered the Chinese people and imposed upon them the opium trade and everything else to suggest that they were a backward people, just the people who had been civilized so long over the rest of you folks didn't make any sense at all. So somewhere it was wonderful to find about the colored peoples of the world that they were very advanced. So I would say today that I'm an American who is infinitely prouder to be of African descent, no question about it. No question about it. I'm an Afro-American, and I don't use the word American ever loosely again.
Okay, Paul Rovers talking about his relationship to America in this Black History Month of February. In reality, every month is Black History Month. We should study the thoughts of those like Paul Robeson and others who have paved the way to continue to struggle for total freedom here in the United States of America. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios. And I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Our call-in number is 1-800-893-9562. This week on the Qumran Report, we would talk about the state of Black theater here in Los Angeles with my in-studio guest, actor Josh Shams, who just finished a 29 straight sellout run of the magnificent Dunbar Hotel, portraying Paul Rovison. And now he's now currently performing in Sassy Mama, which opens this weekend at Theater, located at 5041 West Pico Boulevard. And we will hear more about that in details. Also in the studio with us are the founders of Theater Perception Consortium. Okay, they're wrong. Tanuk, Carla Dupree, and Julian Vasquez. And they're getting ready for another successful run of Sick and Tired about Fannie Lou Hamer. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you.
Now, let's go around the table and start with John. Go around. Can you tell our listening audience, where you're from? How did you first get involved with the theater?
My name is Ja Shams. It's Arabic, and it means beginning sun. So I hold that pretty high. I'm born and raised Los Angeles, California, South Central Los Angeles, now South Los Angeles. But acting became, I did it when I was a kid. Actually, the first play I did was Annie. I played Daddy Warbucks in the fourth grade. So, but it was interesting because even though I was doing that, I didn't really understand. I knew it was acting, but I didn't understand how to get into it. So to go to my parents and say, hey, I want to be an actor, I didn't know how to do that. So I just kept doing stuff in school, talent shows, dancing, all this other kind of stuff. And then, but at the time, my love was football. So I wanted to go to college, play football, get an education, and go to the NFL. But it didn't work out that way. But while I was in college, I fell back in love with acting. And when I came home, I went to college in Colorado. And when I came home, it was football was over. So that the passion for football wasn't there anymore. But I still had this burning inside of me to do something that put me on the same level as playing football. And when I realized it was acting, then I went into it, you know, wholeheartedly and made sure that I put all as much passion that I had into football into acting, and actually more, because once you want to go to that next level, you have to take it serious, put passion into it. So that my love for acting is as deep as it was for football.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. Me playing Paul Robeson, and that was my, he's like one of my idols. So watching his stuff, reading about him, learning about him, and then realizing that, hey, you kind of look like him. So taking all that in, I just, I studied him. I studied Sidney Poitier. Those were the two that when everybody was saying Denzel Washington, you know, but Denzel Washington was saying Sidney Poitier and Paul Robeson. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go to the ones that Denzel said that he looked up to. Mm-hmm. So those are the two guys that I wanted to study and wanted to be like. And the combination of that and really wanting to be an actor and not going to school for it, I needed certain things to look for and to hone in on, and that was it. And what you have today is what that passion that I have.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Okay. Tanook.
I'm Tanook Alexander, and I was born in Houston, Texas. I grew up between Houston, Texas and San Francisco, California, both areas. my first experience in being on stage was in actually church, doing plays at church and for different holidays and what have you. But my after that, in junior high school, they wanted me to be the Statue of Liberty in this play, and I was the Statue of Liberty. And I was in the glee club, and I was a cheerleader, and I was doing all these other things. And I start enjoying acting because in my English class, the teacher would have us reading Shakespeare and all these other classics. And she would have us to act out the roles of these different people. And at first, I was like, I can't do this. But I did, and I started enjoying it. And then I went to school in Colorado also. I went to college in Colorado. And while
which
I was...
Which one was that?
I went to the University of Denver.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I was majoring in education, and some of the classes that we had to take that you would teach to children, one of them was drama and theater. Mm-hmm. And so I... And then I came to Los Angeles, and I started teaching, and I got involved with working with kids in my classroom doing theater. Then I met Carla in 1987. I was on the poet circuit at that time. And I met Carla in 87, in 1987 in Silver Lake. And we started doing poetry together. And then eventually I did a show called Mood Swings, a stage play called Mood Swings. And Carla was one of the actresses in that piece. And I have to go back. After doing that show, Carla came to me along with another friend of hers named Antoine James. And they said, you know, are you interested in doing something collaboratively in theater? And that's how we formed Theater Perception Consortium. Ooh. And it has been an interesting experience and an interesting travel, because I didn't think I could do any acting, although I did all this other stuff with kids and what have you. And Tony Antoine, she did a show called Open Trench Karaoke Club, and Carla was starring in it. And then Tony asked me, would I take the role? And I said, oh, I don't think I could do that. And she said, oh, yes, you can. So I did that, and that was my really first experience out on stage in a stage play as an adult. And then from there, I've just progressed right into what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Because I know Robert Clemens, he hit me with an email, and he said, I know Tanook. He said, Tanook, I know Tanook, right?
Yeah. Robert.
Mm-hmm. My name is Carla Dupree Clark, and I'm originally from Texas, like Tanook, but I'm just from the countryside of Texas. I didn't grow up in Houston, which was about 50 miles from where I grew up, which was called the country. But I moved to California in 1976, and so that means that I've been here almost 40 years, and so now it's my home. And when I was at home in New Waverly, which is where I'm originally from, where I grew up, I was sort of like the kid that could do pretty much anything. So people used to, teachers, they used to call on Carla, you know, she can do it, she can do it. So I would star in all of the little plays and things that they had at home back then, and I liked it a lot. And then they found out that I could read very well. So I was 7 years old when they took me to the radio station, similar to this one, I suppose, back then, and they had me read this long paper that had all these huge words on it that most seven-year-olds couldn't read. And so there I go. I thought I was, you know, destined to do something really big and great, but that didn't happen when I got to the third grade. My third grade teacher didn't seem to be all that so fond of it. So when I got to California, I met a young lady at a job where I was working at Hughes Aircraft Company, Antoine James, and she says, Carla, we're going to a poetry reading. And I said, oh, okay. She said, do you have anything? I said, no, I don't, but I can write something really quickly. So I sat down and I wrote a poem, and it became my signature poem. It's called Gripes, and we went to the poetry reading, which was in a church on Silver Lake in the basement where I met Tanook. And so from there, here we are now today. And we've been mounting and producing stage plays for the last maybe 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I really, really enjoy doing.
Beautiful. Julian.
Hi, Mel. My name is Julian Vasquez, and I was born and raised in Los Angeles as well. In fact, I used to shine shoes right down the street from here in downtown L.A. Mm. and deliver the Sunday paper. I first got the bug for entertainment in 76, and that was to do stand-up comedy, which I did, and got involved with a lot of stars right now. Jerry Seinfeld, Gary Shandling, Bob Saget. I haven't talked to them in a long time, but they started at the same time. Oh, they were doing very well. It's when I started, they were doing very well. But it was in 94 where I decided to study acting. Because I had a job where I had lots of time, and I did a lot of study. I read about Stanislavski, I read about Stella Adler, Meisner, and Strasberg, and the differences among them. And then I interviewed some theaters, and I decided to take classes at the Stella Adler and then a theater in Santa Monica. And I chose to study at the Stella Adler for 2 years. And after that, I taught for 5 years, and that's when I realized the power of the training that I took at Stella Adler. And I am the acting coach here for TPC, and let me say, Larry Robinson is the third member of TPC.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such an honor to work with these talented writers and directors, and I want to thank them again for allowing me to be part of the cast. Mm. And such an important play, Fannie Lou Hamer, in this country, is that I'm fortunate enough to be associated with a corporation, actually, that is funding the next production at the Stella Adler Theater on the February 27, 28, and March 1st. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, because I want to hear more about how Larry got involved when we come around to the history. Talking about the history. And then my father had a church where Fannie Lou Hamer was. It was in Mount Bayou, Mississippi, which is right out from Ruleville in the little area, during the same time. Okay, let's start off with Ja. And I got a few questions I wanted to ask you. Now, how do you prepare for a role when you're first given a script?
Well, the first thing I do is I read it. I know the character that I am, but I read through the whole script just to get an understanding of the whole story. Because the first thing I want to do is understand the story, where my character fits in, and then I take from what's been written, and then I create my own backstory. So where is he from? What does he do? What did he do to get to this point? Why is he doing this? Mm-hmm. And then that allows, that helps with the lines. That helps me memorize the lines because I know, character-wise, I know who I am. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm supposed to do, how I'm supposed to act, speak. And then once all that comes together, when it's time to, before it's even time to perform, rehearsing, the lines may not come out completely right. They may be paraphrased, but mm-hmm. I'm on the same, I'm on the right track. The idea is there, the concept is there. And then once I have that interaction with the other actor, then that helps me to kind of, all right, this is where I need to be. And then the lines come word mm-hmm. for word. So,
now, what was the biggest challenge in playing a historical character like Paul Rose?
It's funny because when in rehearsal for the Magnificent Dunbar Hotel or for the Emperor's Last Performance, because Paul was this giant of a man and had this deep voice, and he was, he was a man. He was, like, for me, he was, other than my dad, he was the black man. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to bring that to the stage and then at the same time knowing deep down inside that I'm silly and once I'm on stage, I want to just, you know, add a little something to it. But that became the challenge because it's like, no, that's mm-hmm. that's Ja. You are Paul. So coming with the deep voice and the pronouncing every word, that had to stay in the forefront and in the back of my mind, I had to be like, dude, be quiet. Because because you're looking at everybody else and they get to be silly and do all these other things, but and you want to do it so bad that you can't. You want to keep basically the legacy that Paul was. You want to, and still is, you want to keep that alive. You don't want to mm-hmm. change it with something else because the majority of the people know Paul wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. So that became the challenge mm-hmm. to kind of be outside of what everybody else is doing to be that man.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the approach? And I'm eventually ask Julian, and want to ask you about the same thing when you doing a production that you've already done in the past, like with Sassy Mama, uh-huh. which you had a run in the. What is this rehearsal like? I mean, what's the challenge in starting up to do it again for another run?
It's interesting because the main challenge is not to get lazy because you've done it before, because you know your role, you know your mm-hmm. character, not to be, all right, we're doing a show, we're going to go up there, I know the lines, I'm going to do it the way I did. And the way I'm moving my face and look at that, you don't want to do that because you still want to give that show. And people that heard about it and didn't come see it, they want to walk in there and see this great show that they've heard about. And the people that seen it, they want to go back in there and see what they saw and if more. So to be able to do that, you have to, now it's about really learning the lines, really learning who this character mm-hmm. is. Like my character, his name is LaDante, and he's the boy toy of one of the women. So it's he's a smart kid, but at the same time, he's from the streets. And he's this opportunity he wants, but at the same time, he doesn't want to, belittle himself. So the great part now is I get to add so much more to it. Mm-hmm. And once you guys have the opportunity to come
yeah.
see it.
Oh, yeah.
Once you come see it, you'll see.
Same director, yeah. right, Alex?
Everything is the same. Same
director. Sammy lighting.
Sammy doing the lights.
Who's the stage manager?
This guy named Daniel.
Okay.
Daniel is young. He's and he's learning this. Mm-hmm. This whole process, and he's getting it. He's I think because the last year when we did it, it was basically, I want to say that was his first time given the reins to be like, hey, this is you. And since then, he's done a couple of other productions, stage managed a couple of other productions, and coming back to do this one. And so just mm-hmm. to watch him work. Yeah, he's watching us work, but to watch him work mm-hmm. and know that he found a home with theater, a home with being comfortable with being a stage manager and directing these great actors, these legends mm-hmm. that like Iona Morris and Denise Dowse and Elaine Taylor, like these women, and giving them and being able to stand up and say, you know, can I get you guys backstage? he's holding his own, and that's a beauty to see.
Give us all of the relevant information again. When is this performed, location, time?
Sassy Mamas opens up this weekend, Valentine's Day weekend. And this weekend is going to be pretty good because it's not just coming to see the show. You, after the show, intermission, you'll get a nice little treats. Probably some giveaways on Saturday, Valentine's Day. There's going to be a nice little party afterwards. So if you can come that weekend, you'll be in for a treat, both seeing the production and talking to the cast and mingling with everybody. And it's at Theater, 5041 West Pico Boulevard. We go Friday and Saturday at 8:00 and Sundays at 2:00. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll come back around and get into more of a deep discussion. Let's move over to New. Can you tell us a little bit more about the founding of the theater company and how Larry got involved?
As I said before, Antoine James, we call her Tony, and Carla came to me and asked, would I be interested in being a part of a theater production company with them? And I said yes. And I had experience with Carla and Tony before with other productions, and as well as the poetry circuit. So Tony, Carla, and I got together and formed the Theater Perception Consortium. And we worked for a while, the three of us together, and eventually Tony, because of her mom's moving to Atlanta, she had to move to Atlanta with her mom because her mom had an illness and she had to take care of her mom. So for a long time, it was just me and Carla for about, what, maybe 2 or 3 years. And then Tony came back into town to visit one time. I think we were doing a show or something. I can't remember. And she says, oh, you guys haven't gotten anybody else? And we said, no. She says, have you guys ever thought about adding a gentleman to the to Theater Perception Consortium? And Carla and I said, we hadn't even thought about it. Just two of us, we just trudging right along, trying to keep it happening. And so Tony recommended Larry. Well, in the meantime, me, Carla, and Larry, we had performed on the poetry circuit together. So we all knew each other. And that's how Larry became involved in the company. And from there, we just branched all out, and we started with North on South Central. And Larry brought the idea and the concept of North on South Central based on his father living in Mississippi and coming to Los Angeles and having worked on Central Avenue into the, yeah. And so that's how Larry became involved with TPC. Short for Theater Perception Consortium. And then each of us, we each have our own little areas that we cover. We write collaboratively, and it's very interesting how we do this. We researched a topic that we want to write on. We're historical writers, and we decide on someone that we'd like to write on, and then we do the research. And Carla is really very good at this. Carla has an excellent vision. And she'll say, oh, let's do it like this. And then she'll say, okay, we break the play up into scenes. And each of us will take scenes. One might start a scene off, like Carla can start a scene off, and she'll bring the scene to me and Larry. We'll look at it and we'll say, oh, okay. And then we each decide on which scenes we want to write on. We take it and we branch off from there. We go to our separate places and write. Then we come back together with those with the scenes we've written and put them together. Carla will edit it and do all the tweaking on it to make sure that it's smooth and running right along, right?
Yeah.
So that's how we do that. And
that's great.
We amaze ourselves at how we do it, because once we see the whole thing, we go, oh, we did this. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Talk about directing the piece.
Well, as I said before, I grew up in this little bitty tiny country town called New Waverly, Texas. So I don't have any formal training as a director. But I do have a clear, concise vision of all the pieces that we write together. And I feel that I am God-inspired. So nothing that we have done so far has proven to be a great task for me to direct. Now, I won't say it hasn't proven to be a great task yet, because North on South Central had approximately 40 people that I had to move around in that particular production. And, yeah, we did do very well. I actually won Best Director from the NAACP Theater Awards for that, for my work on that piece. And it received 4 top awards. So I think I did okay. And then we came with the next piece, which is Howling Blues and Dirty Dogs. That one also was nominated in 3 categories, and we walked away with 2 awards, and I received 1 for Best Director of a Musical. So that made me say, oh, I might be, maybe I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And then we went to work on Sick and Tired, which we're bringing back, and we got nominated in 2 categories, and we walked away with 1 award for Best Female Lead Actress. And I said, well, I had a little bit to do with that, too. Mm-hmm. I received a nomination for Best Director of a Musical, but I was very thrilled that Keturah Baker walked away with the award just this year, 2014. So I do the best that I can, and I'm very pleased so far with the work that I've done.
Okay. Is she the lead in this one?
Yes,
also?
She is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So, Julian, tell us a little. Oh, answer that question for us. What's your process for learning lines?
Well, for learning lines is actually the last thing I do. And as Jaw can understand why, because you have to know the character first. Yeah. And this is how I do it. I'll grab a pencil and I'll read the script 3 times. And I'll mark anything that moves me for whatever reason. Right? And then I will mark. I'll reference pages that are relevant to each other. If something is said in page 34 that is relevant to page 2 or page 3, I'll mark that and I'll dog-ear those pages. Once I'm done reading the script 3 times, then I break it into beats. And a beat is a transition. Mm-hmm. And then I ask 4 questions, and I do ask these of my students. In each beat, I ask, who am I, where am I, what am I doing here, and who am I talking to, right? Once I do that, then I figure, okay, what's the big deal? Where's the drama here? And then as an actor, how do I make this bigger? How do I make this more dramatic? And that's where you put in your own creativeness. Yeah. Figure out, you know, if something happens, some tragedy, big or small, happens on a Monday, and the script, if the script doesn't give you these details, that's when it's juicy for an actor, because then you could put your own stuff in it. So if something, a small tragedy happens on Monday that affects something on Saturday, and the script doesn't tell you what day it is, well, then to make it bigger, you make it Friday. Now you got less time to solve the problem. See, and you don't have to tell anybody, but that brings out the drama in
okay.
it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I know the most amazing thing that I heard about learning lines when we had Libby Lee Simon.
Here, yeah.
And I asked him that, and he told me about Marlon Brando. And I thought it was so amazing. He said the way Marlon Brando learned lines is all throughout his house. He would pace up lines in no particular order, all throughout every room, bathrooms, and all that kind of stuff. Thought that was an amazing way to learn lines. Okay, look, let's open up the round table and talk about the state of Black theater in Los Angeles. So what is the state of Black theater in Los Angeles? Let's start off with y'all and go around. Your thoughts on what you think the state of Black theater.
I think it's, I believe it's still growing. And because I've had the opportunity of doing productions with the Robey Theater, productions with Town Street Theater over at Stella Adler, and just even if it's not with those theater companies doing good black work. Last year I did Sassy Mamas, but I also did a play called One Night in Miami that was about Malcolm X and Cassius Clay and these and Jim Brown and these friends. They were like friends. And we told that story at Theater, and we won Ovation Awards for Best Ensemble, Best Producer, Best Director, NAACP Award for Best Ensemble. So good work that was written by Kemp Powers, black man. So, mm-hmm. And then comes along Sassy Mamas, and that was written by Celeste Bedford Walker, who, black woman. So even though they're not at the theater companies, they're people are writing them. The work is being written, and then you got young playwrights that are coming up.
Okay.
So I think it's growing, and it's good, and it's becoming great work. I haven't had the pleasure of seeing these beautiful women's work or being a part of the theater. But like I said, it's there. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing to do is to have, and I'm pretty sure we'll talk about it later, just to have this one place, this one building mm-hmm. that will hold all of that. That way everybody knows where to go mm-hmm. to see this great work.
Okay. And,
so, yeah, yeah.
What do you think, state of black theater here in Los Angeles?
Well, as he says, it's growing. It is growing. I was surprised to see that there are not that many black theater production companies in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And the ones that are, I've looked some of them up, and I see what they're doing. I see how they've outlined their stuff. I've looked into their websites and what have you. I think they're growing, and I think that, you know, I think you asked me this before some time ago. I find that I liked, and I know it's because of how we write also, original stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We're not doing August Wilson's pieces or somebody else's pieces. We're writing our own stuff. And I find that this Los Angeles, it's a great opportunity for people who are writing original works to mount their original works here to become known for black theater production company. Mm-hmm. So like him, I think it's growing. I think I would like to see it grow faster,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to see more theater pieces being done more frequently in the city through black theater companies.
Okay. What's the biggest challenge for black theater here in Los Angeles, you think?
Probably finances, you know, being able to come up with the finances that it will take to be able to mount a quality production, you know, to get good sponsors, you know, to have the work, you know, be recognized. You know, and it's really difficult, you know, to mount these productions, especially the ones that we mount. They're kind of tough. You know, you have to to go through a lot to mount up a good quality theater production. And we reach out, you know, to people, to media. You know, media is kind of slow to come out and to see your work as well. You know, you really got to jump through a lot of hoops to get them on board your projects, you know. And if they would, you know, give us a little bit more, you know, show up and help us out, you know, help us let people know that we're here, you know, without having to go through a whole lot.
Okay, we're going to talk about that in a minute. What are your thoughts,
Oh, well, I think we have two of the three leaders here in black theater. And this is but you know, is it black theater just because it's serving the blacks or it's serving something that happened in black history? No, it's they're writing a story, a play about Cesar Chavez. It's you know, blacks getting into theater for whatever reason. right? The first maybe my first introduction was Bert and Eddie, about the story of Bert Williams and Eddie Cantor, written by Dick DeBenedictis. And it was about the segregation of production companies in the early 1900s in the Ziegfeld Follies. Yeah. So that was my first introduction. And Dick introduced me to TPC, where I learned about Howling Blues and Dirty Dogs, Big Mama Thornton. And I just loved history. Whether I was in a play called Wallenberg, Raoul Wallenberg, credit with saving close to 100,000 Jews at the end of World War II. I didn't know anything about that, but this was my introduction. So, yeah, and I'm very happy and excited about Vision Theater, which is in the middle of Leonard Park, a black community. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, so I think that's very important. So I think that. Part of it, in my own ignorance too, is trying to. It'd be great to get to the youth and everybody say, "This is how you do this," you know.
Okay.
And
let me, because I want to get into talking about a national theater company. Because not only did we have a national black theater company, we had a national company, the Federal Theater Project. That was paid for by the United States. But let me play this clip. I had Dwayne Ferry in here, and I asked him that question.
Any thoughts on how that could be achieved?
Wow. that's a very lofty dream. I would say what would need to happen first before we go nationally is to establish theater companies like the Roby Theater Company and get them on a higher level, to get them to the place where they're the equivalent of a Mark Taper Forum or the equivalent to a Goodman Theater in Chicago, where they have endowments of, you know, tens of millions of dollars so that we can have equity actors who can make a living wage while they tell these stories that need to be told, so that playwrights can be paid the money they need to live and create. I think it's a lofty and a great idea to have a national black theater. However, that would take government funding and so on and so forth. I think if we start at home, if we start with our own, and especially here in Los Angeles, there are so many people with money who could make a contribution to the Roby Theater Company of $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 every year for the next 10 years. If we had 100 people do that, Roby could do some amazing things. Then we could do original pieces like Melvin Ishmael Johnson's Emperor's Last Performance, and actors can make a living wage. It's very difficult to rehearse for free, relatively, and ask actors to work for free, relatively. Actors are the only people who are asked to work for free. And most people in the theater, the lighting designer, the set designer, the costumer, everybody gets paid. The director, well, not in this particular case, but everyone gets paid. So a national black theater company would be great. But I think they're like... we were talking earlier, you have to crawl before you can walk. I think the crawling would be getting these community-based theaters to get to a higher level, so that once that is established, then it's much easier to do the next one.
Now, before we open this up for discussion, I want to go back to what you mentioned about getting plays reviewed, and then during the 20s, you know, heading up to the Harlem Renaissance period and all of that, you had a person named Theophis Lewis. He reviewed plays because they had the same problem. They wouldn't review the black plays. So the Messenger magazine, A. Philip Randolph and Chandler Orange, they gave him tickets. They said, "We'll buy you tickets to any of the plays that you want to go to." And he would go around. That's how most of the black plays during the 20s, the Lafayette plays and all of that, were reviewed. And then W.E.B. Du Bois, he bleed these two people together. You know, they advocated for a national black theater company situated in the major cities. And Du Bois said that it should have four major components. It should be for us, by us, about us, and near us. And what happened when the Federal Theater Project came into existence, you know, right after the Depression, lasted for about 6 years, and you had different units. You had the Hispanic unit, you had the Jewish unit, the Yiddish theater, the Negro unit. And then, because they felt they had too many communists in the movement, that destroyed the National Theater Company. And then the Federal Theater Project became the Negro Theater. Rose McClinton, Sidney, all of those was young. Ruby Dee, all of them. That's where they got their start. But what happened, you had a conflict between the playwrights and the actors on whether the theater should be an actors' theater or a playwright's theater. And they split and went off in two directions, never put it together. And that's why I always feel that the actors is in trouble right now for what happened. And I put that same question to Kim Sanders, and this is his answer.
Yeah. Well, at the core of the Black experience is being able to think holistically. At the core of the African experience is the ability to think holistically. And even though Du Bois was saying at the starting point it was about the playwrights, he still had a holistic agenda. Mm-hmm. And actors wouldn't have been left out. He was trying to put together a structure so that we could develop a systemic way of sustaining the culture. Mm-hmm. When you are exposed, it's very seductive. Actors were on stage. They were very, it's very seductive when you're getting a lot of attention. And I would assume that that probably had something to do with the split. You know, this desire to be seen as opposed to the desire to maintain the integrity of the mission. And we still have to be mindful of that today because there'll still be those systemic seductive elements out there to try to split up agendas, split up missions. And if we don't have the discipline to recognize that, then we won't have any more success than they did. And we have to be, you know, mature enough to avoid infighting. We have to be mature enough to avoid infighting. It has nothing to do with us disrespecting your individualistic way of thinking, but if you want to collaborate, then there has to be some humility. There has to be some listening, teaching, silence, educating, all happening at once. And what we tend to do is we get lost in what is first, as opposed to saying that's first in a particular perspective. But that's not discounting second, third, fourth, or fifth, because they're all pieces to the puzzle. I think along with grant writing, you're going to need to like appeal to those who have economic power that are not a part of the government.
Yes.
Who look like us,
yes.
Who don't look like us.
Yes.
Who are committed to humanity, committed to children, committed to women's rights. And all of those people need to be addressed at the exact same time. And we need to be careful about pushing each other away, saying that their ideas don't matter. And we also need to like listen to the youth and ask them what are good ideas. And how can those ideas be implemented? Because sometimes the older innkeepers don't want to sit down and let the youth be energetic and use that vibrancy and creativity. Sometimes the youth don't want to sit down and listen and establish their powers and their creativity and their discipline. And so they go out there and it's easy for them to be figured out and they become a casualty. And all of that talent is wasted. So there needs to be a lot of internal work on every person to understand the importance of buying into a collective agenda, because that's who we are as a people.
That's right.
Okay, anybody want to comment on that?
Well, I know both them brothers. And it's when we were doing the Magnificent Dunbar Hotel, just to be able to sit down before the show went up, intermission at the end of the show, and listen to them talk. And both smart, intelligent brothers that really understand theater. Me coming into it after college and it's still fairly new for me, but understanding, like listening to Dwayne and the way he comes at it from the business side of it, from the theater side of it, and then listening to Kim and taking it to where he's coming from it, from the actors, the writers, and just the work, just doing the work. It leads me to believe that it's there to be done again. You know, to get everybody together, to have that one location. Because I look at it, because I actually saw the interview that they did, and listening to them and looking at it at a way to where, like, the any kind of black theater company can be a live museum. Like, you're walking in and you're looking at these people's work, original work, new work. You're just looking at it and you're looking at it like, wow. Like, if you saw the Dunbar Hotel, there was like 20 of us walking around on stage, but 20 of us with names: Lena Horne, Paul Robeson, Paul Lawrence Dunbar. Like, these people are walking on stage and you're learning from them. So to be able to have that in, whether it's in South LA or in East LA or something like that, to where you can bring the neighborhood kids. Like, I love working with kids. Mm-hmm. I actually taught acting to kids at the YMCA and just here and there that want to know. But theater is a beautiful thing, because the one thing you can't do when you go see a movie is at the end of the movie talk to the actors. You can't do that in theater. And now and if the public would understand that, oh, they would come in masses if they understood that they can talk to the actors.
Well, let me ask you this, because one of the major challenges of theater as a whole, especially black theater, and I want to get some comments on this, because up in North Hollywood, right, I remember when that area used to be kind of barren, and then theater companies moved in, and it became a prime area to the extent that the theater companies that started it, they could no longer afford to rent there.
Yeah.
See, now how do you deal with a situation like that? Because isn't finding a space one of the major challenges for a theater company, what we're talking about now?
Well, I would like to say that, you know, having you know, meeting people like Julian Vasquez and people who fall in love with the work that we create, you know, and who's not necessarily, you know, black, African-American, but still has a love for theater and mm-hmm. a love for good, you know, good work. So much so until, you know, it's like, well, let me help you do this, you know. And those are the kinds of people that we need to become, you know, more involved with, not necessarily just black people, you know, mm-hmm. but people who really have a sincere love for theater and a good work. And those people will help us to open up the doors that we need to get opened, you know, and that will give us that push that we need when we're not necessarily financially able to do it, you know. And we have to learn how to depend on one another, you know, to make things happen when we can't necessarily make them happen. But yeah, true enough, mm-hmm. It costs money, like I said before, to rent these theater spaces that's available. We tried to have our own, but, you know, we ran into a little snag, and we're still going to try to have another one. And that's what I think happens. We want our own. All the theater companies probably want their own space, but mm-hmm. they're few and far in between. They're hard to come by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am brought the corporation to fund this, not because it's a black production, because it's a great production, and it gives a history of the United States of America. You know, as tough as it was there, you have these individuals like Fannie Lou Hamer and the Freedom Riders that made a difference, and you got to tell that story in this country. You know, a personal part of me, having been a Marine Lieutenant Colonel, there are a lot of Marines, soldiers, and sailors, and airmen that give their lives up to this freedom. So I'm all about making sure that freedom rings for everybody. Color, creed, sexual orientation. Just don't take the freedoms away. And this is Fannie Lou Hamer, who, you know, mm-hmm. went against everything, willing to give up her life to get people to register to vote. And so so that's what this theater is about. And I have to say something about starting out. I mean, it could be right from the ground, below the ground. I have a friend, Johnny Flowers, who's a comedian. He started doing comedy shows in his garage. And you had to go to the alley to get in the garage. Now he's got venues outside. I might suggest going to American Legion Post, going to your Parks and Recreation, mm-hmm. And say, I want to put a theater on or a show on in your living room. I don't know, but you got to start somewhere. And certainly, like that movie, you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. They build it, and I showed up.
Yeah.
Not that I'm the answer, yeah. But without this, and this allowed me to stretch myself as an actor. When they sent me the script, I wasn't sure why they were doing it. My ignorance, because I'm saying, well, I'm not black, I'm not white. You know, what am I doing here? Mm-hmm. You know, it turns out, you know, a lot of the freedom riders came from different races, yeah. But... So.
Well, and that's one main reason where I look at this as an opportunity and a need to have shows on theater where we can talk about that theater yes. history, where we can get into some of the problems, some of the solutions on a regular basis,
yeah.
you know, to enhance theater. Let's go around for a couple of short comments. We only got probably about 30 seconds apiece for some closing comments.
all I can say is, like you said, you build it, they will come. If you have the work, they will come. And this is a new era. There's, you know, trying to get your piece reviewed. I mean, they got bloggers. Mm-hmm. They got, mm-hmm. you know, people that YouTube channels. You can do all that now to get the word out to come to your shows and stuff like that. And it's. I think it's needed. It's still needed to have that one building mm-hmm. that can house these theater companies that we have. Because I know that the struggle with being an actor is you always, even though you have rehearsal for theater, the rehearsal's not at the theater. You're rehearsing mm-hmm. in somebody's living room mm-hmm. up until it's time to go into the theater. And exactly. that, and when you get in the theater, it changes.
Okay.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Tanu?
I want to look at it from, I want to speak on it from the economic standpoint. In terms of getting people to come to your productions, marketing and advertising is so yeah. key. And when a theater production company does not have the resources, mm-hmm. the money resources to do this, it limits you getting out to the vast public for them to come to your production. Okay. So I think economically, economics is key in making a production company mm-hmm. really be known and getting out there for people to come to your shows.
Yeah. Carla, you want to say so?
Well, all I want to say is I hope that some people are listening to this broadcast that will come to see Sick and Tired, The Freedom Journey of Fannie Lou Hamer.
And it's...
At the Stella Adler Theater, that's 6773 Hollywood Boulevard. And the show opens February 27th, 28th, and March 1. And the March 1st show is at 4 p.m. The other two shows are at 7:30 p.m. And we would love to have you come out and join us at the Stella Adler.
Okay.
Yes. I want to congratulate TPC again, because they've reached out to the youth in elementary schools and help using the theater to guide them to make choices, make right choices for their life and for society, and get into theater, because it is so life enhancing. You could learn a lot. I met freedom riders. I met someone who mm-hmm. knew Fannie Lou Hamer, and she said a line that the registrar has that just it threw me away. But mm-hmm. theater is good for everybody.
Okay, I would like to send a special thanks to Josh Shams, to Nuke, Julian Vasquez and Carla Dupree. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report, and from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with Paul Robeson.
I am an American, born there, my father's slave there. Upon the backs of my people was developed the primary wealth of America. The primary wealth. You have to have accumulated wealth to start, you know, to build. You did it another way here in Australia. You had to build your accumulated wealth too. You just came and took it. You know what I mean? And that's what they did in most of the countries. It's what you West, it's what you Europeans did. You just took it. We got to catch up with you a little bit. So in America, so there's a lot of America that belongs to me yet. You understand? But just like a Scottish American is proud of being from Scotland, I'm proud for being African. Now, in our school books, they tried to tell me that all Africans were savages till I got to London and found most of the Africans I knew and were going to Oxford and Cambridge and doing very well and learned their culture. And even once had, well, somebody had the temerity after one had conquered the Chinese people and imposed upon them the opium trade and everything else to suggest that they were a backward people, just the people who had been civilized so long over the rest of you folks didn't make any sense at all. So somewhere it was wonderful to find about the colored peoples of the world that they were very advanced. So I would say today that I'm an American who is infinitely prouder to be of African descent, no question about it. No question about it. I'm an Afro-American, and I don't use the word American ever loosely again.